The way a civilization treats its children is the best indicator of its values. The better it invests in all its kids, the more it believes in a shared and hopeful future. By that yardstick, the UK is not doing as well as it could and should. More than 30% of our children live in relative poverty. What chance will they have of becoming citizens who can live fulfilling lives and contribute to our economy and society? What's worse, child poverty is now increasingly affecting those whose parents are in employment, as low wages, insecure jobs, and rising living costs leave many working families struggling to make ends meet. One particular flashpoint is the two-child benefit cap, introduced by the Conservative government nearly 10 years ago, preventing families from claiming universal credit or child tax credit for any third or additional children. Introduced to deter couples from having children they couldn't afford, the evidence suggests it's had little effect, but child poverty has got worse. Joining us to talk about all these issues is Alex Beer, Assistant Director of Strategy at the Nuffield Foundation, where she leads strategic research into welfare, work and family, driving projects aimed at improving outcomes for children and families across the UK. Prior to joining the Foundation, Alex was a senior economist in government with over 15 years of professional experience leading evidence-based policy change. She did development of the Department of Work and Pensions evidence strategy, ran the department's model development unit, and worked across government to establish and lead the cross-departmental child poverty unit as its head of strategy and analysis. Quite a roll call there. I was giggling, laughing as I was reading it out. Welcome to the programme. What were you smiling about?
Your pause on model development unit. appealed to, you know, that really brought out the inner geek in me.
When we asked you to come on the We Society, what was your first thought when you heard of this kind of curiously entitled podcast?
You know, when we think about the We Society, we think that, you know, our lives are lived in the society that is around us. They are lived in relation to one another. And that the relative measure of child poverty that we use to sort of determine how many children are living in low incomes, you know, is purposefully chosen because it reflects the living standards that are customary in the society to which we belong. You know, and as a society, as you said, we've got a responsibility to our children and young people.
Argue the biggest. I mean, I would argue the biggest. Yeah. I mean, what's bigger? I mean, climate change, yes, but obviously, you know, we've got to make sure the kids who survive, will prosper in a world of climate change. But I mean, they're co-important, but most important is them.
Yes, indeed, the current generations of children and future generations to come.
Okay, we're going to let's do the big one first. I mean, we've got 31% of our children living in relative poverty. What do we do about it? What's the best way of addressing it? Now, that you could spend the whole hour talking about that, but I just want the things that come into mind almost as bullet points to get us kicked off.
There's no single silver bullet. It requires concerted action, and it needs a holistic approach encompassing, you know, how might you improve people's incomes through employment, through the benefit system? How might you provide these sort of additional services and supports that wrap around children and families that improve their lives in the here and now and lead to better outcomes in the future? So you're thinking about childcare and you're thinking about the role that schools play. And of course, the role that communities and employers play are also incredibly important.
Child poverty is increasing. There's the three child and more cap, which is such a totemic flashpoint at the moment. But actually leaving that aside, it's pretty dire anyway, isn't it? I mean, it's hardly as if kids in two-child families are doing kind of brilliantly well.
No, so you've got, as you've said, more than 30% of children are living in low incomes. It's 31%. It's 4.5 million children. And you've got around half of children living in poverty who are in those larger families. And that number has been on the increase.
It's almost so big, you getting your head around it is kind of almost impossible. I mean, of course, it's nutrition and it's food.
Yes.
I read a book recently, and I had to, this time no mistakes, just to give it a plug. But actually, in the act of writing it, I read Harold Macmillan's Middle Way,
right?
Which he wrote in the late 1930s. And actually, you know, an incredible chunk of that book, written by a liberal Tory, was about nutrition and trying to get minimum standards of nutrition across the British working class, and going into incredible detail about what you should, a balanced diet would look like, how it would cost, how you'd ensure it got to every family in the country. It was incredibly, you could accuse it of being paternalistic, mm-hmm. but it showed a kind of forensicness and a degree of social concern. I mean, part of it was he didn't want them to become socialists and vote communist. He wanted them to be able to lift a rifle and fight in a war, mm-hmm. But he also wanted them to be good citizens. And that's just about nutrition.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about housing or clothes. I mean, where do you begin? Where do you begin?
I think you begin with income. And, you know, how do you ensure that families have, you know, enough money to live on? I mean, one of the big changes in the research world in my time working on child poverty, you know, is that we now have a really good body of evidence that points to the importance of income. That there are two different ways in which you might think about the role that income plays. And one is a family investment model. And that says, well, you know, if the family has the resources it needs to, you know, buy the food it needs, you know, pay for childcare, you know, pay for the resources that you might need for school, you know, then that will lead directly to improvement in child outcomes, you know, health and education and otherwise, and just generally lead to a better childhood, which is important in and of itself. And there's also the family stress model, which relates to the difficulties of making ends meet, coping yep. on a low income,
yep.
that leads to parental stress and mental ill health.
Are there wider problems in society? I mean, some of the kind of philanthropic and religious spurs to action that happened in the last century and again at the end of the 19th century have disappeared. I mean, you've worked, ploughed, you 18 years at the DWP and a goodly number of years at Nuffield. I mean,
yes.
It's great to have you on the field of play, and some of the work you've done is fantastic. But, you know, you must ask yourself the question, how can I get more leverage with this?
When, you know, the Conservative government were making the cuts that I've talked about, they were justified by narratives about, you know, fairness between taxpayers and employment and, you know, those needing support from the benefit system. But I think those narratives, you know, ignore the fact that, you know, so many working families are in poverty and are also interacting with the benefit system. You know, it ignores the fact that families, you know, have crises. They have changes of circumstances. You know, there is disability or ill health, you know, loss of a job that can plunge you into low income. And it would be great if, you know, there was a sort of greater acceptance or the greater awareness that half of us will probably be in touch with the working age benefit system at some point in time during our lives. And so ideally you'd want a benefit system that works for everybody, that works for everybody in moments of need and in moments of crisis. It would be great if, you know, employers were able to saw the benefit of investing in training or of offering flexible jobs so that people can progress in work. You know, evidence is incredibly important to know where you need to put your effort, to where you might want to invest your marginal pound. But, you know, that public opinion is incredibly important in, you know, determining how politicians think they might prioritise across different areas of importance. Some of the research that we have funded, one lot of work during the pandemic, COVID realities, and, you know, that followed families living on low income, both during the pandemic and the subsequent cost of living crisis. One of the things that did was to really sort of surface the voices of families living on low incomes that I think help to combat negative stereotypes that families on benefits are lazy and work shy, because that is definitely not the case.
Tell us about some of the research you funded. I mean, the role of schools, the role of community. Why did you identify those subjects and give us a flavour of the process you go through when you commission it, what you expect the outcomes to be, and how you use them when you get them?
So the Nuffield Foundation, its aims in its founding document are for us to advance social well-being. And we do that by funding rigorous research. And our aim is that we can use sound evidence to improve people's lives. And the fact that we want to improve people's lives requires us to fund research that is addressing inequalities, addressing disadvantage, discrimination, vulnerabilities that people face. And so, one of the really significant pieces of research we've funded that has completed relatively recently has been work by Sarah Catan and the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which has been looking at the long-term effects of Sure Start.
That's great stuff.
Yeah. And what that found is...
It worked markedly across the piece. It worked on health, it worked on educational outcomes, it worked.
That is true. Sure Start really did make a difference. What it offered was family health advice, parenting support, early learning opportunities, childcare, and it was done in a community setting. And in particular, the early Sure Start centres were situated in some of the most disadvantaged areas, and the services were able to adapt to what families in those areas needed.
So I'm sitting in front of, this recent book I wrote, that IFS work was very kind of important building block, actually, for my thinking. And you're the woman who commissioned it.
So we are a responsive funder. And so we create the environment in which people come to us with their great ideas. And then we have the really privileged and difficult job of deciding what to fund, because we get more great ideas than we could possibly fund. But this proposal to look at the long-term effects of Sure Start by the IFS was one of the pieces of work that we did choose to fund.
There's no question that Sure Start made a difference, but what the question was, how much of a difference, and did it really make a difference? And actually, can you build a case that actually even sceptics would accept, and you did.
Yeah. The financial benefits from it, the IFS have calculated, are twice as large as their upfront costs.
Yeah.
So the costs of delivering Sure Start at its peak was $2.7 billion a year. And they have calculated that, for a cohort of kids that went through that year, there have been $2.4 billion of benefits to the public purse, through decreased use of public services, through increased tax and national insurance. And there's a $3.1 billion higher cohort lifetime post-tax earnings benefit, because the children that were exposed to Sure Start went on to have better GCSE results.
This season of the We Society is brought to you in association with the Nuffield Foundation. For more than 80 years, the Nuffield Foundation has funded research and innovations that sit at the heart of some of society's biggest challenges. Evidence has the power to change lives, whether it's improving educational outcomes, reducing inequality, or understanding how society is changing. The Nuffield Foundation's work helps policymakers and practitioners tackle complex problems. To find out more about the foundation and its research centres, visit nuffieldfoundation.org. Let's talk a second or two about the two-child limit.
Yes.
Can you show, in the same way that you proved the case for Sure Start, can you prove the case that this has proved a self-defeating policy?
So we've got some really valuable research by Ruth Patrick, Kitty Stewart, and Aaron Reeves, all who are at different institutions, that shows that neither the two-child limit nor the benefit cap met their stated aims of incentivising families to work more hours, to move house, or to have fewer children. And what the research actually really does is highlight policy assumptions made by those sitting in Whitehall really clash with the everyday experiences of families. So the benefit cap is a limit to the amount of benefit income that you can receive when you are out of work. And the idea was that by imposing that benefit cap, it would incentivize people to move into work because then you wouldn't be subject to it. And what they found was that there was a slight increase in employment, but actually a much larger increase in economic inactivity. So people chose to move further away from the labour market and onto inactive benefits that were not subject to the cap in order to escape it. And it is true that many families on the benefit cap face multiple barriers to work. You know, they have caring responsibilities, they might have long-standing health conditions or be disabled. So there are many hurdles some of those families might have to overcome in order to move into work. There is no evidence that the two-child limit, which is that if you have a third child, you will not get any additional benefit income for that third child. And that holds whether or not you are in work. So there's no evidence that that increased employment. And in fact, we know, you know, those families, they're large families. They, you know, they have a strong commitment to caregiving. They might face challenges with the access or affordability of childcare. So it's, you know, it's quite a challenge to move into work. And the two-child limit also, you know, I think some of the narrative around this was, you know, such that people would take decisions
responsibly. Don't have kids.
Yeah, that if you can't afford them. And there were only very, very small effects on fertility found. And when they explored the reasons why with the families that were subject to the benefit cap, you know, there was a lack of knowledge about the policy. You know, children were born in abusive relationships. And there'd also been changes in circumstances. I would really recommend reading the final report from this research, because there are some really powerful case studies from individuals. You have the family where the daughter became ill, so the mum left her job. This was in a two-parent family where both parents were working. So a family with three children, one of the daughters became ill. The mum left her job in order to be able to look after her daughter. Then during the pandemic, the father lost their job. All of a sudden, they were reliant on benefit income. You know, that family thought that they had a stable, safe and secure base on which to have a family. But when both parents, you know, became out of work, their financial circumstances are obviously very, very different. But they didn't plan for that when they had their children.
So what else have you got up your, what else is up your sleeve?
A continued commitment to, you know, funding evidence that is going to make a difference to people's lives.
But what particular have you got in mind?
As you mentioned at the start, the two-child limit and the benefit cap has become a very totemic issue. So if you were to ask me what would be my first move to tackle child poverty, I would say getting rid of those policies would make a dramatic difference to families' lives in the here and now. It would increase their incomes, and it would have a hugely beneficial effect on the children in those families. It would mean that, you know, schools don't have to work as hard to make up for the fact that, you know, children are less ready to learn when they are coming to school because they are hungry. You know, the schools aren't having to wash children's clothes, yeah, or be that wider support network, because they can focus on, you know, on doing the teaching. But the removal of the two-child limit and the benefit cap has become sort of such a totemic issue that I think it can distract us from the fact that there is a lot more that you need to do in order to tackle child poverty. You need to focus on employment and how you can support parents into good jobs or support them to progress in work. We know from the Deaton Review of Inequalities and the work that they were doing through that on the benefit system, you know, that too often the benefit system and the conditionality regime within that incentivizes people to move into part-time work. It pushes people to move into the first possible job that comes along. And we know that, you know, part-time work is no good in terms of people's longer-term prospects. You might do better to provide higher levels of unemployment support for families so that they can take their time to a bit more time to find a job that suits them and their circumstances and one that they can progress within. And so when we're thinking about, you know, what are some of the research gaps that might exist out there, you know, I'm thinking in terms of how might we take a more dynamic approach and great consideration of the long term when we are thinking about designing policies. How can we protect families from falling into poverty? But how, when we are supporting them into work, we are enabling them to move into work in which they can build their skills and progress and, you know, be lifted off and out of the benefit system to the benefits of the wider economy. So thinking about this sort of interdependence between social policy and economic success is so incredibly important. I think, you know, I mentioned earlier on, you know, that we now have research that shows how important income in and of itself is. But I don't think we know yet. If you were asking me how to spend, you know, that marginal pound, I'm not entirely sure I could tell you, because we don't yet know what the optimal balance is between, you know, improving family incomes and the set of interventions or supports. You know, would you put the money you had available into supporting families or investing it in education? Now, the fact is, those two things are probably going to be complements. You want to invest in education and you want to invest in family incomes. But knowing exactly how to balance that is really, really important. And I think one unexplored issue is the effect of in-work transfers on wage levels.
As I'm listening to you, I think you do a great agenda for action. But I'm also thinking of you know, 18 years at the Department of Work and Pensions, all these, you know, the strategy units you led, the analysis you developed there, and you were in the heart of government. I mean, you were in a position to actually act upon research kind of results that you yourself had either commissioned or were submitted to you. Now, you're outside the tent. Do you ever wish you were back inside the tent?
I loved my time in government. I was a government economist. As you said, I was head of strategy and analysis for the Child Poverty Unit. And in 2008, working on the first child poverty strategy for the unit, there was £1 billion to spend on tackling child poverty. And, you know, working out how best to spend that.
It was a thing.
Was a thing. But there were also lots of unanswered questions that you knew would be helpful to you in making the case for tackling child poverty. I remember when we were trying to make the business case for tackling child poverty to accompany the legislation to enshrine in law the child poverty targets. And it was really difficult to do. There was very little evidence on which to draw about the longer term benefits of increasing family incomes and the impact that would have across different public services. The independence of the Nuffield Foundation and the resources it has means that it can take that longer term view. You know, it doesn't have to answer analytical questions yesterday. You know, it can take its time to support rigorous research and evidence building, like the work on Sure Start, to help to build that case. So although that data wasn't available to me back then, it is available to the newly formed Child Poverty Unit now.
We're going to end, and I want to give you, a chance to say, a rallying call. What is your kind of, message to me and the listeners? What is your kind of, this is when they wrap up this podcast, what are they to think?
So I mentioned that the COVID Realities Research Programme involved an awful lot of families living in low income, and hearing directly from them about their experiences. And the same was true from the qualitative research on larger families. So I'd like to thank those families for the time that they gave. And I'd also like to end with the words of one of them, if I may. So this was Eric. He took part in the COVID Realities research. Too many families do not have the support in order for them to be able to bring up their children in a way that does not leave them feeling they do not have the same opportunities in life that others do. It is not the fault of the children, but it is often them that suffer, which in turn can impact on their future lives. I hope that in the end, the government will take note of the problems families on low incomes face, making changes that will make a real difference to people's lives.
Well, on that note, Alex, let's finish. Thank you. Thank you for coming in, and thank you for, whether it be the benefits of Sure Start or the kind of the lack of success in the benefit cap and the two-child limit, you've covered a lot of ground. And you've also shown us, I think, a bit about social science in action. So good on you, and great good luck in your career ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistle Down production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.